Shrink Wrap Radio number 583, Coffee with Freud, with Professor Brett Carr.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my return guest is Professor Brett Carr, noted British psychoanalyst and author. Back in September of last year, we had a delightful discussion about his book, Tea with Winnicott, and today we'll be discussing his 2017 book, Coffee with Freud. For more information about Professor Brett Carr, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Professor Brett Carr, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It is such a pleasure to be back here. I so enjoyed our last conversation. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, yeah. We spoke back in September of last year about your delightful book, Tea with Winnicott. But let me congratulate you again on the subsequent book, Coffee with Freud. I'm happy to say you pulled off the illusion once again. Before I knew it, I felt I was truly reading an interview with the founder of psychoanalysis. In fact, I probably should have opened this show with Dr. Sigmund Freud. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio. Because the illusion is just so complete.
Well, I had great fun. I had great fun writing both Tea with Winnicott and Coffee with Freud. And it really grew out of my teaching of young students, because I find that, you know, nowadays, young students of psychology and psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, they're so overwhelmed by a growing literature. The literature, as you know, has really exploded in recent decades, and it's often very, very hard for newcomers to the field to really get their head round the very extensive body of writings of all of these major figures. So I came upon the idea that it would be helpful, perhaps, of bringing Donald Winnicott back from the dead for a day, bringing Sigmund Freud back from the dead, and engaging them in what I call a posthumous interview, so that we could try to find a way to capture some of the essence of their life and work for young students.
Yeah, not just young students. I have to say that I was educated in the process of going through both of those books, learned a lot that I was not aware of. So, you know, I'm happily going to recommend this book, not just to people who are novices, but all the way up the chain. I think there would be few people that would already be aware of everything that you have covered, because there's so many very interesting details. And speaking of the young students, you one of the things that you emphasize early on in the book, and this is something that I've emphasized with my own students back when I was teaching, is that we live in a post-Freudian world. Tell us about that.
Yes, a post-Freudian world. Well, I suppose I live in a Freudian world, really.
Yes, you do.
Because Freud has had such a huge influence on my thinking. So I sometimes refer to myself as rather a 19th century Freudian who happens to be living in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. But you're right, we do live in a post-Freudian world. Whether we are aware of it or not, the impact of that extraordinary Austrian man continues to linger in the most profound way. And I think one of the great surprises for young people today who have grown up in the, you know, the post-feminism movement, the post-sexual diversity liberation movement, is this sense that actually one can only speak about sexuality in such a straightforward, increasingly less ashamed way, I think because of the contributions of Freud. He really was one of the very first strongest and most consistent and most persistent figures to help us speak about sex in ordinary language.
Yes.
You must remember, David, that back in the 19th century when Freud trained, many references to sexuality in medical textbooks would have been written not in the vernacular, but rather in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you consult a copy of the first edition of Richard von Krafft-Ebing's textbook on sexual psychopathology, it has a Latin title, Psychopathia Sexualis, the psychopathology of sexuality.
Fascinating.
And if you look through the book, many of the case studies of very, what one might call, you know, aberrant or illegal sexual crimes, they're written in Latin so that if an ordinary member of the public not trained in medicine should happen to stumble upon it, they would not have necessarily been able to read it.
Yeah.
And Freud said, no, sexuality is rife. It's part of the very fabric of our character. We must talk about it in a direct way. And when we keep sexual secrets, this is the cause of the neuroses. So Freud was although Freud led by many standards a rather quiet, conservative, go-to-bed after supper kind of bourgeois life, if you like. He was not a raver. He was not a party boy. but nonetheless, he had this extraordinary frank capacity to engage with human sexuality. And I don't think that people alive today quite fully appreciate how Freud gave us language for sex.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't even thought about it in that context when I've spoken to students about living in a post-Freudian world. And in part, I think that we are like the fish in water who supposedly is unaware of the water that they exist in. And our whole way of speaking about, you know, we're used to the idea of an unconscious. We take that for granted. We use words like repression and suppression and all the other blocking on them now. All those other words that we psychological, really psychoanalytic words that we take for granted. You know, things related
absolutely.
To unconscious motivation.
He gave us a whole new vocabulary for thinking about private life.
Yeah.
For example, you know, often quoted concept which Freud wrote about is just the very, very basic universal notion of sibling rivalry, for example.
Yes.
It's very hard to find precursors in the psychological literature or indeed the philosophical literature to the explosivity that can take place between tiny brothers and sisters over the affection of their mummies and their daddies. So Freud really took us into the fabric of daily family life and helped us to come to appreciate how rife it is with violence, with murderous thoughts and feelings.
I have to share with you a couple of stories. One fairly recently, one of my little granddaughters, who was quite young, my daughter had yet another baby, and so we have this infant on the floor, and I noticed that my granddaughter, who might have been 3 or 4, I'm not sure, maybe younger, surreptitiously stepping on his hand. You know, when nobody was looking.
absolutely.
And going further back, I remember my son, who is now in his 40s, being in the crib. I used to travel on business, and he's in the crib, and I'm back, you know, and he says something to me along the lines of, "Daddy, I wish you would go on a long trip and not come back."
I
think he pretty much said, you know, so that I can be with mommy.
These,
so it's real stuff.
The, those are two utterly magnificent illustrations, and I think Freud would have been delighted by them and would have written them down and would have published them in the next edition of one of his textbooks, because that is precisely the kind of seemingly throwaway minutiae of daily family life, which for Freud was absolutely fundamental. And Freud would say, for example, in the story of your elder grandchild stepping on the hand of your younger grandchild, you know, unless they're listening to this podcast years hence, they may not remember those anecdotes. But Freud says, actually, these are the kind of basic interactional challenges that each of us has trying to find our place in the family and consequently in the wider world at large.
Yeah, so repression and denial are two more words that come to mind that are definitely of Freudian origin. And even people who dispute Freud and don't believe in anything that he did will use those words.
I think that's true. That there has been from the inception a long tradition of hostility towards Freud, which sits alongside a very, very long tradition of people who are respectful and appreciative. Freud is what we might refer to as a transference figure, where many people will have the capacity to project their own love and appreciation or their own hatred and contempt onto this man in the way one might onto an American president, you know. Not to mention any names. There will be people who will adore a particular president and others who will loathe that person and wish him or her ill.
Yes.
So Freud has that iconic status, and he's very much used by people either as a vehicle for love, admiration, and inclusion, or as a vehicle for attack. And I don't mind which view people adopt of Freud. There are some very seasoned critiques by very intelligent people. But what one often has to say when you hear non-Freudian psychologists, for example, or academics of one sort or another lambasting Freud, expressing hugely hateful views of Freud, often many of these people have not read a single word of Freud. He's probably the person in Western civilization about whom most is written and least is read. Everybody has a view. Everybody thinks that he or she is expert on Freud, but very few have actually really, really done the homework to engage with his very vast corpus of writings in depth, in detail.
Yeah.
And Freud deserves that, because he spent an entire lifetime, as did the many generations of his colleagues, really, really investigating the private mind and the private family life with tremendous care and tremendous thoughtfulness.
Yeah. One of the things that you underscored that I'd never really thought about is that his influence stretches across three centuries, the 19th, the 20th, and the 21st. And, you know, evidence of that is you wrote this book as recently as 2017, and
and
you're not alone in that the literature continues to expand. So that's really remarkable. You highlight three major contributions that we can attribute to Freud, and I wonder if you could just quickly take us through those.
Yes, of course. These are Freud's own designations. He was very, very proud of the fact that he had created a phenomenon, a body of knowledge called psychoanalysis. And he said that psychoanalysis can really be thought about as a creature with three different functions, three different parts. And perhaps first and foremost, it is a method of treatment for psychoanalysis. psychological, call it psychological illness, psychological unwellness, treatment of the neuroses. It's a form of therapy. That is its first and primary function. And of course, in the classical psychoanalytical model, a patient will come to the office of a psychoanalyst, will often recline on the famous Freudian analytical couch, which helps to relax you and removes you from the eye contact, the facial contact, which can often inhibit intimate confessions. The patient will lie down on the couch and will engage in the art of free association, narrating his or her most private thoughts, and this brings often tremendous relief. So first and foremost, it's the model of therapy created and developed by Freud. Secondly, psychoanalysis is a body of theory to help us understand the nature of the human mind. It's a theory of psychology. It sits alongside other theories of psychology. I would put forward the argument that it's the most rich and detailed, and one that goes beneath the surface of consciousness. So much of contemporary and academic psychology deals with overt behavior and overt cognitions, often aspects of one's life which are known to the subject and known to the investigator, but the body of psychoanalytical theory really has at its core an investigation of the parts of the mind of which we as human beings are not consciously aware. And Freud referred to this famously, of course, as the unconscious mind.
Yeah.
So psychoanalysis is a collectivity of theory, a set of ideas about how this unconscious mind works, how it functions, how it undermines us, how it contributes to the formation of our neurotic symptomatology or even more severe forms of psychological distress, and so forth. So firstly, a method of therapy. Secondly, a body of theory. And thirdly, psychoanalysis can be described as a lens, if you like, a way of looking at the world, a type of investigation. And in recent decades, the psychoanalytical community has become particularly adept at applying the very fruits of psychoanalysis beyond the consulting room, outside the consulting room, to fields such as politics, economics, literature, art history, culture at large. Freud, of course, led the way. He wrote about virtually every topic from a psychoanalytical perspective, and nowadays we will apply that to all kinds of new areas that Freud never knew about and never thought about, including climate change. I recently went to a fascinating conference here in London on psychoanalysis and climate change. Do mental health professionals have anything to contribute to this very, very scary debate?
Huh.
And in fact, it was very, very eye-opening, and looked at the way in which the inability of most human beings to engage with climate change is a real dangerous reality for one's grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren in years to come, and even for our own contemporary lives. One of the functions is that we do not like unpleasantness. We banish unpleasant thoughts from our mind.
Yeah.
The thought that the planet might be self-destructing or that we might have destroyed the planet already is so unbearable that we don't engage with it, which means we don't recycle or we don't contribute to debates or help political organizations or charities that are actively involved in it or contribute to research and so forth. And that's in many, many respects like, you know, somebody suffering from extreme alcoholism who just puts his or her head in the ground like an ostrich.
Sure.
And doesn't deal with it consciously and hopes that it might not be noticed or might just go away.
Yeah,
so to the third area is very, very exciting.
Yeah, go ahead.
The third area is very exciting, David, which is to see, does psychoanalysis have something to say about the broader social, cultural, political aspects that color our lives in such fundamental ways?
Yeah, I just want to make a comment about treatment and theory. There over the years, I've seen students and young professionals who had rejected the treatment part of it, but are later come back to do additional study because the approach that they've become married to somehow wasn't providing them the depth of theory that they were longing for in terms of the functioning of the human mind.
I think that happens quite a lot. I've had over the years quite a number of very, very serious colleagues who have been practicing in the mental health field in one form or another for decades. Some come from the humanistic psychology background, some come from cognitive behavioral backgrounds and so forth. Very good, very decent people. But some of them have come to sort of, you know, old 19th century Freudians such as myself and said, you know what, we really feel that we haven't quite got to the roots of our patients' suffering, and they still have some of the symptoms with which they first began, and we just haven't managed it. So late in life, they'll come back and engage in more training and supervision to try to increase their psychodynamic depth. And yes. Certainly, I have found as a Freudian practitioner, as a psychoanalytical practitioner, that it's a very, very profound method of treatment.
Yeah.
It's not a magical panacea. Some people have less than pleasant experiences in it, and that can be for a number of reasons. Not every practitioner is always helpful with every patient. Some, as in any profession, can be, you know, less than inspiring. But in my experience, the vast majority of people who engage in a profound experience of psychoanalytical therapy and stick with it over time will experience very, very profound characterological changes and will come to inhabit a more peaceful mind. That's certainly been my experience.
Yeah. You know, a phrase that kind of surprised me was invention of psychoanalysis. Now, I never thought of it as an invention, although it really makes sense. Did Freud ever use that phrase? Did he claim to have, quotes, invented psychoanalysis?
He tended to use the term discovered. It was more. I think if you look at his writings, he's more likely to have described himself as the discoverer of some of these basic facts.
Mm-hmm.
And although Freud is often accused by many critics, but particularly one vocal critic who's just recently published a very, very scathing intellectual biography of Freud. Many critics claim that Freud basically stole all his ideas from many predecessors, that one can find, you know, earlier hints of unconscious and the talking therapy, you know, back in the writings of the ancient Greeks. And that's certainly true. But Freud was not trained as a philosopher per se. He was a physician. He used these insights about the unconscious to try to alleviate mental distress. And I think that nobody has created as many new and original ideas as well as such a consistent body of theory and has applied it to patients and has created a training system for practitioners to learn the art of psychoanalysis, as well as an international movement. You know, even if we find that Johann Wolfgang von Goethe had anticipated some of Freud's observations about family life, or that Plato had a notion of unconscious mental life, and so forth, nobody really applied that knowledge and cohered that knowledge into a really, really credible system of ideas, and then applied it to the study of mental illness per se.
Sure.
So I think from that point of view, I would be happy to refer to Freud as not only a discoverer, but also an inventor of psychoanalysis, even though, of course, he was an erudite scholar, and he drew, as all good scholars do, from every one of his predecessors. Freud read almost everything. He really, really did immerse himself in a world of books.
Yes,
and his books were very carefully read, and he, you know, he Freud would have been, had Freud lived today, he would have been, you know, a full professor at an American university on a high salary. He was a remarkable scholar, and he did learn from others, and he did cite others. He doesn't, I don't agree with the notion that he stole ideas without proper credit. Freud very, very often cites his sources in great detail,
yeah,
and drew from such a range of sources, from other physicians, from philosophers, and from literature. His knowledge of Western literature was really, really quite profound. And the two figures whom Freud, as a doctor, as a neurologist, come psychoanalyst, the two figures whom he cites more frequently than anybody else in his writings are Johann Wolfgang von Goethe and William Shakespeare.
Uh-huh.
Now these men are not mental health specialists.
Right.
They're authors. They're littérateurs, but they provided an immense amount of inspiration to Freud.
Yeah. Well, whether a discovery or an invention, one of the things that you beautifully highlight is the degree to which psychoanalysis is a paradigm shift. And let's go into that. I love your detailing of psychiatry pre and post Freud. And so what did psychiatry look like before Freud?
I think that few people nowadays truly appreciate the barbarism of what we would now call the mental health profession during the 19th century. And most of the people who practiced the psychiatric arts at that time, were they alive today, they would be struck off their medical registers, and many would be imprisoned for cruelty.
Yeah.
The primary treatment for what we would now call mental illness during the 19th century was undoubtedly abandonment and neglect. Most people who experienced psychological difficulties, whether severe anxiety, depression, even psychosis, would have been just left to their own devices to get along with it. Some would have broken down, would have ended up sleeping on the streets, and would have become known as pauper lunatics. At least that would have been the phrase used in this country and Great Britain. They were mostly ignored and not given any proper treatment. Many would be beaten. Many would be thrown into prisons. The neglect was really, really quite rife. Those individuals who did develop very, very severe illnesses, which did require institutionalization, would invariably be sent to lunatic asylums. It would not be correct to call those institutions psychiatric hospitals. They were literally lunatic asylums. They were deemed, these people, as crazy, and they were locked up, and often for very, very extended periods of time. During the mid-19th century, when Freud was a young boy, it was not at all uncommon for lunatics in asylums to be chained to walls, chained to floors. They would often not have any change of clothing for days at a time, and sometimes the people who were put in charge of monitoring the wards were themselves criminals who were given a choice. You can either go to prison or you can become a warder on the ward of a lunatic asylum.
Wow.
So the conditions were really, really very, very cruel, very, very barbaric.
Including, as you point out, surgical mutilations of hysterics, both male and female?
Yes, in the late 19th century, there began a very, very prominent and surprisingly frequent movement in the United States, in Great Britain, in France and Germany, and Austria, and some other countries as well, but in all the major European countries, and certainly in the Americas, of hysterectomy and clitoridectomy, the surgical removal of the uterus and or the surgical removal of the clitoris in female patients diagnosed as hysterical, and in male patients diagnosed with dementia praecox, what we would nowadays call schizophrenia, several physicians recommended the surgical removal of the testicles as an ostensible treatment for this very severe form of psychological illness. So we've really come to think of it nowadays, modern historians of psychiatry, as a chapter of basically genital mutilation, bodily mutilation, masquerading as a form of authorized treatment. And Freud knew about this tradition, and he was absolutely appalled by the cruelty of late 19th century treatment of the mentally unwell, which included also the use of electrical currents, not what we would now think of as electroshock therapy applied to the cranium, but there was a very, very wide movement in the latter part of the 19th century, but particularly so in Austria, of administering small, bearable electric shocks to the muscles in the arms and legs and torso. It was known as electrotherapy, designed to relax the patient. So this was a very, very common treatment. Hypnosis was used. Patients who had greater financial resources were sometimes sent to spas, to baths, to take a cure, a water cure. It was known as hydrotherapy. That was very popular if you happened to have money. So it was really a whole grab bag of different types of treatment, ranging from physical cruelty to neglect to basically being fobbed off and saying, you know, Fräulein X, go and have a 2-week holiday in Baden-Baden, and let's see how your depression is when you come back. There was no systematic attempt to really try to work through the traumata of patients' early lives.
Yeah, and some of the other things that you kind of brought to light are the whole process of grand rounds, as they used to be practiced. And there were no conversations with patients to try to understand the context of their lives and all of that. And nudity was frequent in terms of kind of parading the patient who's being presented in the grand rounds with all men in white surgical coats, and the female being paraded around in nudity and poked at, and as a demonstration, as a kind of performance, without any real...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Throughout the latter part of the 19th century and in the periods which preceded the latter part of the 19th century, the patient's body really did become a piece of spectacle. And doctors would often, as you say, conduct their grand rounds in front of large groups of students and other medical colleagues. And if they wished to examine a particular part of the patient's body, they would simply remove the patient's clothing, ask the patient to remove the clothing in front of a large group of people. So patients were examined either completely nude, semi-nude, in front of everybody else, and they certainly were not given an opportunity to tell their private stories. Nobody really had a profound sense that early childhood experiences or private sexual experiences might contribute to the development of psychological symptomatology. So patients were really very, very badly humiliated at that time. This is the climate, this is the context in which Freud first begins to embrace the study of psychological unwellness. And in fact, although he did study under men who held professorships of psychiatry, Freud never became officially a psychiatrist himself. He went through his medical training and he concentrated in neurology rather than psychiatry or asylum medicine. Back then, when Freud was in medical school in Vienna in the 1870s and then into the very, very early 1880s, psychiatry was really the, shall we call it, the waste paper basket of medicine. It was the most reviled, least respected branch of medicine, and mostly psychiatrists were keepers of the keys. They had you locked up in asylums, and they opened the door and put you in the wards, and if you were lucky, then you got out. These were very, we should also say, David, that the psychiatric facilities, such as they were at that time, had no privacy. There's a wonderful, wonderful Freud historian, historian of psychiatry and history of medicine in Tübingen in Germany, Professor Albrecht Hirschmöller, who discovered the floor plans of the hospital where Freud worked in Vienna. And he discovered that there were absolutely no private consulting rooms in which the psychiatric physicians could talk in peace and privacy with the patients. All of the examinations of patients were done in one great big cattle-like ward, like a military barracks, so that if you wanted to interview your patient, everybody else on the ward would see it and hear it. Freud, when he really began to insist upon the tiny private consulting room, was really trying to formalize privacy as an essential component of psychological healing. Yeah. He believed that unless you can see your patient without an audience, without a physical audience looking on, you'll never get them to tell the true story of what is ailing them.
Yeah, so there was part of this paradigm shift, a major part of it was the move towards treating patients with respect, creating the privacy that you're speaking of, and using conversation as the tool, both in terms of, you know, referred to as the talking cure, but also, as you point out, a listening cure. That it was, you know, that up to that point, people with mental illness were not listened to. They weren't taken seriously. And so that's a major shift.
That's absolutely true. If you look at the medical literature in the pre-Freudian era, you would be very hard-pressed to find any articles in medical periodicals, whether in English, French, German, irrespective of the language, which actually quote the patient's narrative in any detail. Basically, you look at a case report from 1890 in one of the neurological journals, and the doctor will write, you know, Mrs. X came to see me with such and such a symptom, I diagnosed such and such an illness, and I prescribed such and such a treatment. There's no fine-grain engagement with the detail of the patient's story. And Freud is really one of the very first physicians who wrote these case histories, which read like little novels, because he quotes the patient's dialogue. He says to his patients, you know, hello, what's brought you here? And then he quotes them directly and large chunks of their exact words, or his best memory of their exact words. So Freud really brought conversation into the treatment of mental illness in a consistent and profound way. And I think you're absolutely right to stress, David, that Freud did introduce a paradigm shift in psychiatry, because he created the first hands-off treatment of patients. You know, most physicians, when you go to a physician for an examination, most doctors are likely to touch you somewhere, even if it's something as simple as taking your pulse or taking your blood pressure. It's very unusual to have a consultation with a physician which does not involve your doctor's hands. But Freud, apart from the initial handshake and perhaps a handshake at the end of the psychoanalytical session, was very, very clear that this is a form of treatment in which the doctor does not touch the patient physically, but attempts to engage the patient in conversation in a way that can be touching emotionally. We try to touch our patients with our hearts and souls, with compassion and with understanding, not with our hands. So yeah. Freud was unusual among doctors in that he, although he started as a traditional physician, Freud did practice hypnosis initially. He did apply these electric currents to his patients' bodies. But he simply found that these were not truly efficacious treatments. And so he said, we're going to do something radical. And he created this paradigm shift where he never put his hands on his patients' bodies. And he said, just lie on this couch, relax, don't look at me. That will interfere with your ability to really tell me the most private and shameful of secrets, particularly sexual secrets and murderous thoughts. And out it all came in conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, and some people have found it hard to believe, you know, the idea of childhood sexual trauma. And I think Freud may have even backed away from that a little bit at a point. But all you have to do is read today's headlines to see there was a period during which it was thought that, these are just sort of false memories that adults have about having been abused as children. However, in today's headlines, we regularly see true accounts of children
Absolutely.
Who are abused sexually by
Absolutely.
Parents, by relatives, by strangers, etc. And sexuality was so denied. I loved your anecdote that in that period, there were some people who went so far as to cover the piano with a tablecloth so as to hide the piano's legs.
Absolutely. I don't think it is appreciated how utterly shocking bare legs would have been at that time. If you read the memoir written by the eldest of Freud's sons, Freud had six children, three boys and three girls. His eldest son, Martin Freud, wrote a memoir of his father and a family life, published in 1957. It's a lovely, lovely book, which I recommend very warmly, called Glory Reflected, about his memories of his father and growing up in the Freud household. And the Freud family absolutely loved their summer holidays, and Freud was a great swimmer. I don't know if that's appreciated about Freud.
Yeah,
we tend to think of him in his suit and tie, smoking his cigars. But he did love to go in the water, and so did the children. But Martin Freud reminisces in this autobiography that his aunt, who lived with them the whole of his childhood, basically, he never ever once saw her bare legs, even on swimming holidays. It would have been really, really shocking for women to expose parts of their flesh. And what's very, very interesting is that back in Freud's day, back in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, many, many psychiatric physicians would have encountered patients who were deeply sexually aroused by the sight of a bare ankle, a woman's ankle.
Yes.
Now, I've been practicing in the mental health profession for a very long time, and I have never, ever, ever encountered a patient who becomes sexually aroused by the sight of a naked ankle. You know, bodies are so much more exposed now.
Right, right.
I don't think a little bit of flesh around the ankle is going to excite people. People
yeah.
become excited by what they can't touch and what they can't see. But because there was so much sexual repression in those proto-Victorian times, and women were dressed in corsets and, you know, innumerable layers of undergarments, the ankle, just a flash of an ankle, would have been the 19th century equivalent of, you know, watching every pornographic film on a loop today.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I can well imagine that. You know, there were some things that I learned, some of the misconceptions that I think people have about Freud and how he worked. I was interested to see that, you know, you talked about the detailed case histories, but he was against taking notes during the session. And I think often cartoons, at least, portray the psychoanalyst as having a notepad on his lap and he's taking notes.
Absolutely. No, that's a very cunning observation you've made. Most Hollywood film directors do not always do their due diligence and their homework. And I suppose, as one of my colleagues here in London, the lovely Dr. Susie Orbach, a psychoanalyst, often says, psychotherapy is not a spectator sport. It's not filmic to look at, because if one were to film a session, you'd see one person sitting in a chair, nodding and listening quietly, and another person just lying on a couch, whispering their private thoughts. So I think when the profession does get filmed on television or for movies, they need to give the analyst something to do to make it a bit more animated. So you're right, they usually do have a notepad. But Freud was very, very explicit back in 1909 when he published the case history of an obsessional male patient, the person we've come to know as the Rat Man, one of Freud's most famous case histories. He absolutely recommended, indeed insisted, that one should not take notes during session, because it will not only interfere with the analyst's capacity to listen uninterruptedly if you're so busy scribbling everything down, but I think that something else that can be very complicated about note-taking within the psychoanalytical session is that when the patient hears you scribbling behind the couch with your pencil, however quietly you do it, it evokes some anxiety about confidentiality. I think the patient can't see you scribbling or hear you scribbling without wondering, well, what will happen to these notes?
Yeah, and confidentiality in itself is another one of those post-Freudian innovations when it comes to treating mental illness. The idea that a person had privacy rights
and
didn't
to remain
exist at all.
Extremely confidential.
Yeah.
You know, most of us who work psychoanalytically, our patients know that their stories will go with us to our grave, and that will be the end of it. We don't leave notes behind, and we are professionally obliged also that any written notes we keep for our own purposes, we must destroy them on a regular basis so that the privacy of the patient is protected. And those of my colleagues and I who do keep notes, we never put the patient's name on it. Every patient that I see has a code. So if somebody should happen to stumble upon a note that I've written discreetly about Mr. X or Mrs. Y, all they'll find out is that, you know, a person with a particular number and a particular set of letters happened to come and see me on a particular day. So privacy and discretion, professional privacy, confidentiality, these are absolutely essential features of the psychoanalytical situation, and we take them very, very seriously indeed.
Yeah. And is it true that Freud never said a cigar is just a cigar? This is attributed to him all over the place.
The lovely psychologist Alan Elms, who I think may be a neighbor of yours in California, wrote a very, very extended and well-researched paper on this. And to the best of our knowledge, no one can find a trace of Freud ever having said a cigar is just a cigar. Perhaps a letter may emerge someday with the original source, but it seems to be that this is rather an apocryphal story. And I don't think Freud, given his theory of symbolism, would ever have believed that a cigar really is just a cigar.
Yes.
Freud could always see the phallic significance of anything penetrative or jutting, the womb-like significance of anything, you know, containing and so forth. So he always looked for what is beneath the surface of something.
Yeah, you know, in my coming up in all this, the analyst was often portrayed as needing to present a blank screen so that the patient could be free to project their fantasies on the analyst.
Yes.
But when we, I wonder if Freud really did that, because you highlight his fascination with antiquities, and I was shocked to read that, you know, there's a museum full of some, what, 2,000 antiquities that he had collected. So he seemed, and he was seeing his patients in his house. So that it hardly sounds like a blank screen with all these clues to who he was scattered all about the room.
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. The notion of the blank screen, it's not a term I think that contemporary Freudian practitioners use as much as our predecessors in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s even would have done, because I think it has a misleading sense that if one is a blank screen, i.e. not talking about one's own private self, that one becomes then this sort of invisible antiseptic person. And of course, one isn't an invisible antiseptic person in the consulting room. Even if you are seated behind the patient and the patient is not looking at you, they know from your physical appearance, they know from your tone of voice, all sorts of things about you. They can look to see whether you're wearing a wedding band on your fourth finger of your left hand. They might know whether you're married or not. In this day and age, with Googling, Googling has really changed the game entirely. In the old days, patients really did know absolutely nothing about you. But now, if you punch in the name of your psychotherapist or psychoanalyst into the search engine, you can find out all sorts of things. So nobody really is a blank screen anymore. We all have histories. We all have lives. Some of us have publications which are, you know, widely available online, and so on and so on. But I think what psychoanalytical practitioners really cherish nowadays is the notion of neutrality. It's not that we try to be blank screens. It's that we try to be neutral and to not engage in acts of self-disclosure which are unnecessary or which pull the focus away from the patient. We try to really keep our own lives out of the consulting room as much as we can. And I think American analysts are particularly annexed to your private domestic home. You can't work there. I think you can, and many people do. In Great Britain, it's much more common for a lot of colleagues to work from offices within their private family home. Freud certainly worked always from his own home on the Berggasse in Vienna. And it was not what we would call a neutral environment, because, as you say, he lived and worked in the family home. His housekeeper during later years, Fräulein Paula Fichtel, would answer the door. She would take the patient's hat and coat. They might have a little chat, and she'd say, "Sit in the waiting room. The Herr Professor will be with you shortly." Freud shared a waiting room with his youngest daughter, Anna Freud, the famous child psychoanalyst. So patients met one another. And then you go into Freud's consulting room, and as you say, we now have in the Freud Museum in London approximately 2,000 of the ancient artifacts that he collected from Greece, from Rome, Etruscan statues, Egyptian statues, funeral monuments, all sorts of objets. And this is not necessarily a neutral environment. So patients knew a very, very great deal about Freud. I think, given that he was the founder of psychoanalysis and had to invent and create and discover all of this, Freud was not as classically Freudian as the many people who followed him since.
For example, I want to touch on the length of treatment. I know you highlighted one of his famous cases where he saw the patient 6 days a week for 7 weeks, and that was the treatment. What was typical for Freud, if it's possible to say, in terms of length of treatment?
Well, it's interesting. There's a very, very accomplished German historian of psychoanalysis, Dr. Ulrike May, who has published a book in German. The English translation is literally on the verge of being published, and it's a marvelous book about Freud at work, Freud at the office. And she has researched very, very carefully his clinical diaries. So we actually know from the archival investigations of these clinical diaries the precise number of sessions that Freud had with many, many, many of his patients during the middle and latter part of his career. We don't have quite so much documentary evidence still about the very early part of his professional practice. That has not survived to the best of our knowledge. But sometimes Freud would see somebody once, but more frequently he recommended intensive analysis, which at that time involved coming 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday inclusive. Patients would attend the sessions on Saturday. Freud worked throughout the day on Saturday, as well as the traditional Monday to Friday work week. And treatments lasted from often several months. I would say until the 1920s, it was not unusual for patients to come for a few months here, a few months there. And by the 1920s, we find that treatments started to lengthen. So some of the visiting American students would stay for a year, some for 2 years, some for 3 years. Freud did have patients who had long stretches of treatment over many, many years, but the majority, I'd say, stayed for shorter periods of time, although in the post-Freudian era, psychoanalytical treatment has become, in many, many instances, a longer process, especially in Great Britain, where the notion of the lengthy analysis has always been cherished to really get to the deep roots. And people find it a very useful process. It's not unusual for patients to come for 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, what have you. One works as long as both parties find that there's still some work to be done. And many of the most mentally healthy people, the most creative people that I know, are people who have engaged in very long multi-frequency analyses, coming several times per week.
There was one line in the book that you quoted that we could spend probably several hours on looking at the implications, and so we don't want to do that. But there's a point at which you have Freud observing that psychoanalysis is not so much a cure as transforming from misery to ordinary unhappiness. I thought that was a very interesting quote, and struck me as very sophisticated, if I can say that, of Freud.
Yes, that quotation about the goal of treatment to transform misery into ordinary unhappiness, that quotation evokes an enormous range of reactions, I find, among readers, among students, among colleagues. You'll find that in the really groundbreaking book that Freud published in 1895, shortly before his 40th birthday, known in English as The Studies on Hysteria, which he co-authored with his senior mentor, Dr. Josef Breuer, who was one of Vienna's most esteemed general physicians and also a researcher, a scientific researcher in his own right. And really, together, they tried to lay the foundations for what came to be known as psychoanalysis, as the talking cure, in this book on the Studies on Hysteria. And a lot of people have said, you know, gosh, turning misery into ordinary unhappiness, that doesn't sound like such a great offer, you know, especially nowadays with all the research on positive psychology and flow and flourishing and being the best that you can. People say they want to turn their misery into delirious happiness, not ordinary unhappiness. But I think Freud was already, even as a man of 39, quite quite aware and quite honest that to be a human being, you know, however much joy and delight you have and however many, you know, meditation weekends you go on and workshops and what have you for self-development, it's very, very challenging to be a human being. You, the moment you're born, you deal with death. You deal with the incipient death of your loved ones and the gradual decay and death of your own body. So I think Freud is being really very sober and very honest when he says that actually we're not going to promise delirious happiness. We're going to help you deal with the ordinary unhappiness of everyday life.
Yes, and there's a whole sort of branch of therapy dealing with existential analysis that I think is grounded in that observation that to be alive is to you know, suffer both the highs and the lows.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think you've put that really, really very well. So I think Freud is being, I think he's being quite honest that to cope with ordinary unhappiness is part of maturity. If not, one is in a real state of denial and not engaging with the inevitable ugliness of private life.
Yeah, yeah. I also wanted to highlight the degree to which Freud's career really for a long time was a very uphill slog. You point out that he was very ambitious. I think from early on it seemed that he really intended to make his mark somehow on the world, and he certainly did. And so, but he had to deal with the fact that he was Jewish. He describes himself as a godless Jew. He had to face the outrage of at his sexual theories. He had enormous family responsibilities, both the family that he grew up in and then the large family that he created, and dealt with a constant struggle to make enough money. And also, he made important discoveries that were slighted. So I'll just lay all those out, and you can comment on any of that that you wish.
Yes, you put that list together really very well, and I think it demonstrates that Freud really had big struggles, big challenges in terms of establishing himself in the world, as many people do. You know, he came from very, very humble origins. His father, Jakob Freud, was a wool merchant. He sold wool from one part of the Austrian Empire to the other. He did not make a great deal of money. The family often struggled hugely. Freud had many, many younger siblings, five sisters, two brothers, one of whom died quite young. The family really, really struggled financially, living in reasonably cramped quarters for the longest time. And, you know, here was Freud, a boy who had tremendous observational capacities. He noticed everything. He saw everything. I don't think this is widely known, but when he was a little boy, when he was newly born in 1856, his family lived in one little room as lodgers in the home of a locksmith in the Austrian town of Freiberg. With, you know, the little locks and the pieces of metal and so forth. And little did anybody know that Sigmund Freud was going to be the man who one day would unlock the secrets of the human mind. So he literally began playing with locks and keys and so forth, and continued to do so in a more metaphorical way for the whole of his career. But he really did come from very humble origins, so it was a struggle for him to get through. The nature of anti-Semitism in Vienna at that time, it should not be underestimated at all. When Freud was a young man, the mayor of Vienna, a man by the name of Karl Lueger, was an overt anti-Semite. In fact, Adolf Hitler later referred to this Viennese mayor as one of his sources of inspiration. And Karl Lueger became elected on an overtly anti-Semitic ticket. Mm-hmm. Now, Vienna did have a protected Jewish community with a lot of doctors and lawyers and artists. So there were other Jews who had paved professional paths, but nonetheless, there was still a sense that one was potentially endangered and that one was in a minority. So Freud did have a lot of battles, a lot of struggles, but he persevered. He got through his medical training. He had hoped to embark upon a career as a physiological and neurological researcher, but was discouraged from that. There were not many paid opportunities for full-time employment in the medical faculty at the University of Vienna, and although there were Jewish professors, they were in the minority. So Freud really had to embark upon private medical practice, which was not top of his list, but he found a way to make it lucrative, to make it scientifically engaging for himself. And then he replicated his own background, coming from this very large multi-sibling family, by having six children of his own. So he had to support himself, his wife, six children, his wife's spinster sister, as they would have said at that time, as well as quite a number of members of staff. Having housekeepers, maids, chambermaids, and cooks and barbers was not nearly as expensive back then as it would be nowadays. So I don't think it's widely known that Freud had several servants in his employ. But he did have a lot of mouths to feed.
Yeah.
So he worked very hard and started seeing patients early in the morning and went straight through into the late afternoon, early evening. And then in the evening had meetings, did his writing, professional writings, books and papers, attended to his voluminous national and international correspondence. He was a true, true workaholic.
Wow, yeah. And he also got some grants, didn't he? So grants, scholarships, whatever you might say, as a student.
Mm.
And isn't that how he was able to go to Paris and study with Charcot?
Yes, that's a whole separate story. But you're right. He did impress some of his senior mentors when he was a young medical student and then a young qualified physician. And I think we do have to mention Paris. I'm glad you brought that up, because in 1885 he received a traveling stipendium, a stipend, or we'd say today a traveling bursary, to go to Paris and also to Berlin, but he spent most of his time in Paris, where he had the privilege of studying in the neurological service of France's great professor of neuropathology, a man by the name of Jean-Martin Charcot, who was known as the Napoleon of the neuroses. He was a remarkable neurologist. There are many neurological conditions that bear Charcot's name to this very day. But Charcot really helped to put the field of neurology on the map. But after he'd done a lot of his basic organic anatomical neurological research, he began towards the latter part of his life to look at the neuroses, conditions which often came into the purview of neurologists. But Charcot said, actually, there are some patients we see in our service who have no organic impairment whatsoever, but they come in with these pseudo-neurological symptoms like paralyses, contractures, and so forth. But actually, when you examine them, one can't find anything wrong with them from the neurological point of view. And Charcot began to put forward the idea that many of these neurotic patients actually have suffered from various psychological traumas, and that when one put them under hypnosis, these symptoms, these seemingly neurological symptoms, symptoms would sometimes disappear. So a patient who came into Charcot's clinic with a paralyzed leg, hopping, not able to put any pressure on the leg, Charcot would then hypnotize this patient, and the paralysis, the pseudo-paralysis, would disappear. And Charcot said, actually, there's nothing medically wrong with this person, but something is going wrong in the psychological arena. So they were operating from a particular model of a split between the body and the mind at that time, which of course still penetrates our thinking in many circles nowadays. But Freud, as a young doctor visiting Charcot, he arrived at Charcot's hospital, the famous Salpêtrière, which, by the way, is the hospital where many years later Princess Diana breathed her last breath after her tragic fatal car crash back in 1997. So that's the site in which Freud was studying with Jean-Martin Charcot, and he was very, very struck by what he learned from Charcot, as he was in Vienna when he collaborated with Breuer, the Viennese physician, who said that actually, if you talk to patients, sometimes their symptoms start to diminish in intensity. So Freud took these experiences with Breuer in Vienna, Charcot in Paris, and he then came back to Vienna and opened his private practice at Easter time in 1886, just literally days before his 30th birthday. And he said, folks, I am going to experiment with conversational therapy with the neuroses, and let's see where this goes.
Well, that's early on. So he wasn't quite 30 yet when he makes this big transition. And one interesting thing is that he finally gets on top of his finances, I think, at some point in his career, due to the many Americans who had learned of him and traveled and were willing to pay decent fees, handsome fees.
I think it's not fully appreciated how much Freud owed to his American colleagues, because by the 1920s, after the First World War and after international travel resumed more freely, in 1918, an Englishman called David Forsyth came over to Vienna for analysis, and then 1919-1920, a whole barrage of Americans, mostly doctors from New York and also Boston, came to Freud for analysis, and they had money. Many of them had well-funded American travel grants. Many came from wealthy families, and at that time, going to Vienna as a young doctor was really part of your kind of medical finishing school. It was part of the grand tour, as it was known, and being in analysis in Vienna was part of your kind of medical psychiatric finishing school, and nothing would have been more prestigious by the post-Great War era than being in analysis with Freud, whether for 6 months, whether for a year. And he charged many of them high fees. The Americans generally paid anywhere between $20 and $30 for one analytic hour. Now, you'll know better than I, David, but, you know, $20 American dollars, it's not an insignificant sum of money now in 2018, but 100 years ago, $20 was a pretty substantial amount of money for an hourly rate. And that put Freud in a more comfortable, more secure financial position. And he had great expenses, not least, as you know, in 1923, he became diagnosed with cancer. And that proved to be not only life-threatening and very, very physically painful, but also expensive, because he had so many consultations with physicians and of every description, x-rays, treatments, multiple surgeries over a 16-year period. So he had huge outgoings from that respect.
Yeah, what an ordeal. And I was surprised to read that he ended up with actually a wooden jaw as a prosthesis.
Indeed, he had so many surgeries, about 30 surgeries between 1923 and his death in 1939. and the surgeries, you know, really progressed from one bit of evisceration to the next, and eventually, you know, several years in, he had large parts of his jawbone physically removed, and a wooden prosthesis inserted in its place, and it was deeply, deeply painful for him because the state of plastic surgery at that time was really very rudimentary compared to what we have nowadays, and just getting it to fit comfortably in his mouth was rather difficult. It had to be taken out every day and cleaned. His daughter Anna Freud, who became his nurse and his psychoanalytical successor as one of the founders of child psychoanalysis, she had the very intimate task of refitting and scrubbing clean her father's prosthesis every day. And there was a little special area within the apartment in Vienna where Anna Freud would do this. So Freud had a lot of physical pain, a lot of suffering, and it even impaired his speech at one point because having a chunk of wood stuck in your mouth does have an impact on your speech capacities.
I would think so. Jumping back a bit, I didn't fully appreciate the fact that Freud came up in a time of what I would characterize as a medical renaissance, that there, particularly in Vienna and other parts of that part of the world, were immensely famous scientists, medical scientists, whose names most of us have never heard. Mm-hmm. And don't recognize today. Mm-hmm. So there's part of your book reads like portions in the Old Testament. I don't remember if it was Numbers or Chronicle. So-and-so begat so-and-so who begat yes. so-and-so. So there's this list of really famous breakthrough researchers, and Freud studied with them, was rubbing elbows with them, was in this sort of cultural stew that, and he also spoke something like six languages, and even as a student, he worked as a translator, and the process of doing the translations was also part of his education.
Yes. No. You know, you're right. I do focus at some length in the book Coffee with Freud on his formation as a young medical student. I think it was very important because, as you've rightly said, he studied with some of the greatest minds in Viennese medicine, Viennese science. There was a real renaissance within the Vienna Medical School at that time. It was deeply, deeply highly regarded. They had some remarkable people there who made enormous innovations in practically every branch of the medical sciences, from surgery to dermatology, and some great names. He had many mentors, but I think the person who most impacted upon him was the noted physiologist Ernst Wilhelm von Brücke. And he ran the Physiological Institute in the university at Vienna and really took Freud in as what was known as a famulus or an assistant, and gave him research tasks, taught him how to use a microscope, how to dye material tissues, how to soak them in stains, so that Freud became really a pioneer in the use of staining processes in histological research. And I think had it not been for the anti-Semitism at the time, Freud could have had a very, very successful career as either a physiological researcher or as a clinical neurologist had he been able to stick with it, and had he felt confident that he could have earned a living from doing so. But Freud had some wonderful, wonderful mentors, and he studied with his mentors very carefully. He was a very, very adept very committed student. And don't forget that just as Freud was coming up through the ranks, he matriculated to the medical faculty in Vienna in 1873. And of course, this is right at the real apex of the emergence into the German-speaking countries of the work of Charles Darwin. Freud was very, very much influenced by Darwin. And one of Freud's first mentors, Professor Karl Klaus, knew Charles Darwin personally and had corresponded with him. In fact, I think several of the people with whom Freud worked had had Darwin connections of one sort or another. And that had really changed the stakes in scientific research, this move away from an uncritical religiosity towards the use of scientific observation, the use of scientific method. So the impact of Darwin on Freud, there has been a lot written about it in the specialist psychoanalytical literature and the history of science literature, but I don't think most people who are coming to this study for the first time really appreciate how Freud was very, very much soaked in Darwinianism. And if you come and visit the Freud Museum in London today, and it would be my pleasure to give you a private tour of that, David.
Wow.
You'll see there's a whole shelf of Freud's editions of early Darwin books, many in German translation, and some with his signature as a young medical student on the inside flyleaf. They're very, very crumbly copies, beautifully maintained by our archivist and curator, but they're very, very old. They date from the 1860s and 1870s, and they're much thumbed through. So Freud really did soak up Darwin. And in later years, Freud put himself in the same class as Darwin when he said that both he and Darwin were among the great minds who shook the confidence of the world, because Darwin told us that we're not really descended from Adam and Eve. We were, you know, slightly more sophisticated versions of protoplasmic slime. And Freud said that what he did is to show that actually we are not masters in our own house. We are controlled by unconscious forces of which we are not aware. We're controlled by powerful sexual and aggressive urges that often get the better of us as human beings. And in a way, his model of mankind, womankind, humankind, was not dissimilar to Darwin's from that point of view, in that each of those men challenged the kind of proto-narcissism of human beings.
Yeah, wow. So I've been reflecting on psychoanalytic practice then and now, and wondering how Freud would respond to some of the current developments. For example, I was surprised to hear a few years back that there is an emerging field known as neuropsychoanalysis. And I'm thinking that before Freud came on the scene, the treatment approach was very somatic, with attention on the body and doing punishing things for the most part to the body. And in a sense, it's sort of come full circle in some ways, where we have renewed attention on the brain and excitement about the brain. And we also have people who describe themselves as somatic practitioners. You quote Freud in one place saying, "One cannot treat a psychological illness with a somatic remedy." However, today, there are many people who would disagree.
Absolutely. You know, although in this book I attempted to bring Freud back to life and to spend a day with him in the 21st century, it was less to expose him to the 21st century than to use me as a conduit to introduce the 19th century Freud to the 21st century. So although I think I make a mention to computers and television and Skype calls, and Freud seems a bit bewildered by these modern references as I attempt to explain what a television set is. I don't know what Freud would have made of our modern psychological marketplace, because it is overstuffed with practitioners and experts from every possible type of therapy that you can imagine. As you know only too well, I think many of these people have been privileged to be your guests on Shrink Wrap Radio over over the years. So you, David, perhaps more than anybody, have a good sense of the wide canvas of possibilities. So I don't know what Freud would have made of all of these different schools of thought. I secretly suspect that were he alive today, he would look at it and say, actually, folks, we've already got a pretty good, very clear, very straightforward method, which is the classical talking cure, 1 hour per patient per day, ongoingly, to let the conversation unfold, and that one doesn't need techniques and remedies and exercises and whatnot. One just lets the conversation speak for itself, and the story comes out. So I think, had Freud been practicing today, I rather suspect that he might still be a classical Freudian.
Okay. Well, before we wrap up, I want to turn the spotlight on another star in this story, who's Professor Brett Carr. And because I think you bring so much to this work. And you have, at the end of the book, an epilogue in which you kind of describe your journey into Freudiana, if you will, into the psychoanalytic world. Mm-hmm. And how old were you when you first discovered Freud?
Oh, I was a baby when I first encountered Freud. I don't know exactly how, but really in my adolescence, I found my way into some of Freud's texts. I don't think I understood very much, if anything at all, but I was certainly intrigued by reading this man. There was something that really gripped me, and this is by no means an unusual experience. I mean, I have so many colleagues and friends who also came to Freud as quite young people, and really became captivated by his prose, by his research knowledge, by his wisdom, by his erudition, by his writing. I really, really loved Freud as a literary stylist, and still do. He's one of the most compelling writers, a great rhetorician, and he's very, very helpful to his readers, because he tries to, when he discusses a particular problem, he tries to anticipate the reader's anxieties and objections. So he'll regularly say, "Now, dear reader, I hear you wondering, how can this possibly be? Let mm-hmm. me tell you." So yeah. He's very good as a writer, and of course, as you know, he received the famous Goethe Prize for literature, named after his hero Johann Wolfgang von German literary practitioner. So Freud was an excellent stylist, and I think I fell in love with his writing style as much as with his ideas, and I suppose my interest really grew from there, and I just began to apply myself and really became a keen student of psychology, but particularly of its history. I must tell you that although I studied as diligently as I possibly could all the new experiments in psychology. David?
Yeah, we just had another dropout.
We had a dropout, unfortunately, yes.
Yeah, so I'd like to finish up this section here before I let you go. And you were just saying something about how you tried to keep up with... I'm not sure what.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find a link sentence to come back to where I left off.
Okay, great.
Okay. Yes, as a young student, I really tried to be as thorough and as diligent, learning all the new research, reading all the new psychological studies and ideas. But nothing quite gripped me as much as the classical Freud writings. I really felt by reading Freud that I was learning something really profound about the darker, more secret, often more sinister aspects of the human mind. And I became really rather captivated by this man's writings. And I think if I say nothing else in this interview, I think it's important perhaps for young students who might have a bit of suspicion towards Freud, or who might never have read any Freud, or can't quite figure out, you know, what's all the fuss about this bearded Viennese man. I would say that having now been reading Freud for at least 40 years, probably yes, longer than 40 years, I find him more and more interesting the more I read him. One never tires of him. And there are not many writers, there are not many thinkers about whom one can say that with a real sense of sincerity and conviction. I just learn more and more from him each time I read him.
Yeah.
And he is the person I take with me daily into my consulting room. He's always there on my shoulder, helping me to decipher the often cryptic and tormented communications of the patients with whom I have the privilege of working.
Well, I also want to underscore that not just all the reading that you've done of Freud directly, and also so many of the books of the huge literature about Freud, but you also sought to, you point out you were too late to interview him, and really just on the almost too late to interview that first generation of analysts, but you went after everybody that you could find that had any connection to Freud.
Young man. Yes, as a young man and as a sort of incipient psychoanalytical historian, in my early 20s, I did write to and meet quite a number of people who had actually had some contact with Sigmund Freud. I was in my 20s; they were all in their 80s, and I wanted to interview them. I wanted to meet them and get some kind of first-hand sense. And when I was a young student back at the University of Oxford, there was no Freudian study at all. Freud was very much regarded with tremendous suspicion. And as a real youngster, I set up a study group, a series of public lectures, where I invited all the most elderly, venerable Freudian practitioners that I could possibly find. And they all came to Oxford very generously and gave lectures, and I think that helped to introduce some Freudianism into the community there. The very first person that I had come and speak was the late, great Dr. Muriel Gardner, who had tea with Freud one day as a young trainee psychoanalyst in Vienna back in the 1930s. And then I met Dr. Josefina Strauss, who was a great personal friend to Anna Freud, and she had the distinction of literally carrying the 83-year-old fragile Freud onto the train, which took him away from Vienna towards freedom in London back in 1938 when he fled from the Nazis. So this woman literally was a young doctor, and she literally, you know, held him up by the arm because he was so frail and so weak. So I think meeting these early Freudians, all now deceased, of course, was a great treat, and it really helped to bring Freud's world alive to me and make it very vibrant and very real.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you ever had any dreams featuring Freud.
Oh, what a good question. That's such a very, very good question. Nobody has ever asked me that before. Do you know, I'm not aware that I've ever met Freud in a nighttime dream.
Well, maybe that's yet to come. I planted perhaps, a suggestion here.
Perhaps that will come tonight. We shall have to see. But no, I'm not aware that Freud has appeared in an overt, identifiable form in my dreams. That's very interesting. Perhaps because I spend so much time with him during the daytime, my yearning for contact with him is satisfied in that respect.
Yeah, well, I really feel that there's some sense in which you have channeled him. I'm wondering if maybe some sort of spiritual osmosis has happened. You describe yourself as a 19th century man, and so I imagine you wearing a waistcoat, a vest, and a suit. Do you do that regularly
yes,
or not?
I think I would have been very happy in the 19th century. There's there's something about that quality of a kind of formality, but also I hope a gentlemanliness that I try to bring into the consulting room today.
And that's what you do. I mean, that's what I get from you in our conversations, and I find it, you know, rare and delightful. So
you are a gentleman, David. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So I guess, you know, I've held you long. I'm really grateful for your willingness to share so much of yourself with us here today. And Professor Brett Carr, I want to thank you for being my guest again, and hopefully not for the last time on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Such a privilege. I'm so grateful.
You know, it's such a delight to speak with Professor Brett Carr. He's not only a world-class scholar and psychoanalyst, but also extremely generous and gracious. As you hear me imply at the end of our interview, I think he's taken on some of the qualities of a more genteel age. He describes himself as a 19th century man, and I would add that's in a good way, the best of those qualities. One offshoot of that, however, is that he doesn't do Skype video, so unfortunately, there's no YouTube version of the interview. One of the ways his generosity manifested today is that our interview ran long, an hour and a half, and that, for him, was at the end of a full day of seeing his psychoanalytic patients. It's wonderful that he could give us such energy at the end of such a day. You might hear a couple of spots in the audio where there are discontinuities due to Skype dropping the call. Fortunately, we were able to reconnect and did our best to pick up the conversation from where it dropped. I've done my best to smooth those out. This episode is already sufficiently long that I won't go into a lot of my own commentary. But I do want to share with you some of my own thoughts about Freud's use of the couch and free association. Professor Carr shared his observations that the couch provides the patient comfort and freedom from the analyst's gaze. We know that Freud initially was drawn to use hypnosis as a tool for getting at the contents of the unconscious. However, he found hypnosis to be unreliable, working for some and not others. I think the reason hypnosis works for some is that it induces an altered state of consciousness. And I think that being in an altered state of consciousness facilitates access to the unconscious. I'm not sure exactly how Freud hit on the idea of the couch, but it's clear that the couch also induces an altered state of consciousness, putting one in the attitude of sleep, and sleep being associated with dreaming, which Freud famously referred to as the royal road to the unconscious. So while the patient on the couch is not supposed to actually go to sleep, it does facilitate a more dreamy state of mind and one that is less critical than the normal waking state. The invitation to engage in free association dovetails nicely with the couch because it asks the patient to suspend critical judgments and to be open to whatever arises in the unconscious. According to Professor Carr, the German phrase that has been traditionally translated as free association actually connotes something less deliberate sounding and more like, quotes, letting the mind dance. I'm happy to urge you to purchase his book, Coffee with Freud. We were able to but scratch the surface of this volume that is both relatively brief, at less than 300 pages, and at the same time chock full of fascinating detail. I think this is a book that any and everyone can learn from, whether novice or seasoned professional. Written as an interview, it draws you in. In that sense, it's easy reading, but doesn't talk down to you at all. You'll really feel like you're reading an interview with Sigmund Freud conducted in one of his favorite Viennese pastry restaurants. If you decide to follow up on my recommendation, you can use the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com. Just click on either of the two book ads near the top of the page, and then you can proceed to search for Coffee with Freud by Brett Carr. Given how long today's show has been already, I'm going to skip the appeal for your financial support and listener emails and go straight to letting you know that my next week's guest will be Dr. David Treleaven on trauma-sensitive mindfulness. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.